Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Leah Remini was probably most famous as a comedic actor in the sitcom King of Queens. But in the last few years, she's become really known as the serious and formidable activist against a multi-billion-dollar cult. And she published this memoir like 5 years ago called Troublemaker, Surviving Hollywood and Scientology. And in this book, she talked about her 30 years as a Scientologist, her escape, and her crusade that's happened since. She wants to expose this damaging, corrupt cult and culture of abuse and enslavement. She described being physically abused by a member of the church when she was just a teen. She talked about child abuse rampant, neglect rampant within the nurseries of the church, managed by unqualified workers in unsanitary messes of filth and flies and you name it. She had to steal food when she was hungry. She paid a steep financial price for moving up the ladder within Scientology, trying to achieve this, I don't know, transcendent spiritual state. Her family ended up more than $250,000 in debt to the church, over $500,000 for some other people. They mortgage their homes. They sell all their possessions. They're essentially owned by the church, which, quote, employs them for as little as pennies an hour. This keeps them dependent. Well, 2 years before Leah Remini's best-selling book was published, her story was actually made public by my guest today, Tony Ortega, who runs the website Underground Bunker. Tony's a journalist and author. He's also a co-host on the Cult Awareness podcast. He's been following Scientology for a long time. He knows his stuff. Tony, it's great to talk to you, man.
Thanks for having me on again, Seth.
How did I do on the setup?
That's a great summary of her book. I'd actually forgotten some of those details. You really know that book well.
You know, we're at this fortunate place where the public is finally getting educated about the teachings and practices of Scientology. The mystery is starting, the fog is starting to clear. But I also know that a lot of my listeners, they know the name, but they don't really know much about the cult. So forgive me for asking. But can you give me, if we were talking over coffee, how would you describe Scientology?
Okay, the real quick version. A mid-century science fiction writer by the name of L. Ron Hubbard in the year 1950 put out a book called Dianetics, in which he claimed that he was the first human being ever to understand how the mind actually works. And he explained that the mind was actually cut up into a couple of different parts, and that as adults, we were suffering from traumatic memories, and the most important ones were while we were a fetus in the womb. And if we could just remember what terrible things had happened to us while we were a fetus in the womb, it would solve all of our adult problems. This created a real craze for a year. A lot of people around the country wanted to try to remember what it was like to be a fetus and then be born. 2 years later, after he had gone bankrupt and was rebuilding, and the name Dianetics is actually in bankruptcy, he came up with a new idea called, he had to call it Scientology. Well, that was what he wanted to call it. So Dianetics became Scientology. Now, Scientology added a new layer, and that was you weren't just trying to remember what happened to you in the womb. You were going back to previous lives. So instead of what happened to you as a fetus affecting you today as an adult, you were trying to remember what happened to you thousands or millions of years ago on other planets. that causes you to have problems today. So that's what Scientology is. If that sounds surprising to you, it's because the Church of Scientology today never talks about what it actually does. This, they call this auditing. It's their word for counseling, to help you remember what happened to you in previous lives that causes your problems today. And if you can remember all of those experiences going back millions, even trillions of years, then you will become what's called ultimately an operating Thetan. This is what Hubbard promised was the end goal of Scientology. You would have memories going back trillions of years. You would finally know who you really are. And as an operating Thetan, you would have godlike powers. In one of his lectures, he actually said that an operating Thetan would be able to crush a planet between thumb and forefinger. So this is what Scientology offers. It's basically a sort of offering godhood, and it comes with a godlike price. This process can cost up to $2 million over 15 or 20 years, and that's what these people are chasing.
Okay, but at the beginning of the conversation, you know, I got troubles. I'm having trouble with the boss. My marriage is on the rocks. I have depression. And so Scientology finds me at that point in my life, and they say, you know what, we've got some kind of Tony Robbins, happy, happy, joy, joy, motivational stuff that will help you. So they don't talk to me about hydrogen bombs in volcanoes and Xenu, the intergalactic overlord, and all the crazy shit. They don't tell me anything about that at the beginning of these conversations, right?
Right. It's gradual, and they try to make it initially seem more like a business seminar, and they say they have great communication skills that they can impart on you. And also, I think part of the appeal is that rather than come in, and they call themselves a church, so you kind of expect maybe there's some sort of a Bible or that I'm going to be reading and learning all their traditions. Instead, it's all about you. You know, they want you to talk about your issues. They want you to talk about your memories. It's all about you, you, you. And so that's kind of the seductive thing about it. And you gradually are taught or indoctrinated in these various processes, and they're very repetitive and they're very rote. You have to do things a certain way. One of the first things you do in Scientology is these marathon staring contests. You literally just sit in a chair opposite another person whose knees are practically touching yours, and you have to meet their gaze without flinching for hours.
Wow.
And it's just to train you to become completely compliant to what they want you to do. Yeah, the space opera comes later, but you know one of the mistakes that people make is they think that you don't get any of it till OT3, and that's not true. The space opera does come in pretty soon because you start to read what are called the basics, and these are the original books of Scientology, and here are some of the original lectures, and the space opera is in there, and fairly early on you are being put through this auditing and asked to go back in time. So, but you're right, it's gradual. And by the time it gets really crazy, you're so sunk into this thing, it becomes very difficult to back out at that point.
The word space opera, that just has to go. I'm going to have to make a note of that and use that moving forward when speaking about Scientology. I can get it. I mean, people in a vulnerable place, they want to talk about themselves. It's kind of therapy. It's counseling. You're in there and you're holding this e-meter, this device, which has no, I think it actually has to have a disclaimer tag on the device, right? That this serves no medical purpose.
Right, because all it's measuring is what's called skin galvanism. When you are subjected to a polygraph examination, a so-called lie detector machine, there are four inputs: your respiration, your blood pressure, your pulse rate, and skin galvanism. These are the four things that the examiner is looking at when he's asking you questions. And the most he can say is that, well, when I asked this question, they showed stress, right? That I could see based on their pulse going up, their respiration changing, their blood pressure changing, their skin galvanism reacting, that question, they were under stress when they answered. They can't say that what he said was a lie. All they can say is they were stressed. And that's why courts are iffy on lie detector machines. They're not reading your mind. Now, in Scientology, the e-meter is only one of those four things, just the skin galvanism. And yet they really believe that this thing has this incredible accuracy and is literally reading your mind and knows when you're lying to it. And the thing is, if you believe that you can't lie to the machine, then it becomes a very, very powerful interrogation device. Because if you believe you can't get a secret past it, you'll spill everything.
And that becomes blackmail material, right? Down the way, if you decide to go out and expose, criticize the church, they got the goods on you.
Right. So they're asking you, what are these terrible things that have happened in your life? And then, of course, once you start telling stories, they really bore into it. And these sessions are marathon sessions, and they want every detail from your sex life, from everything. And, of course, they're writing everything down. And, you amass these gigantic folders of material that they can mine later if you decide to leave and speak out against them. I mean, we've seen it. I remember Leah Remini had an episode with a guy that had revealed some financial chicanery involving their fundraising for buildings. Just outrageous material. And sure enough, the next day, Scientology on one of its websites has put up information about this guy that could only have come from one of his confessional sessions. So, I mean, that's part of the reason why they do this, is they want to get this information about you in case they need to use it later.
I picture all these huge name Hollywood celebrities who've, you know, they've been in there bearing their souls. And so let's say they start to have doubts. Holy shit, my whole reputation, the tabloids will go nuts. If this comes out, I'm screwed, kind of thing. I mean, the church kind of has them by the balls, right?
Well, there's definitely the threat of that. But I do want to, sometimes people will point to that and say, like Travolta or Cruz, that's the only reason they're still in. I definitely want to argue against that. And I know it's hard to believe, but people like John Travolta and Tom Cruise are Scientologists primarily because they really believe it. Yes, of course, they would face the possibility of some very embarrassing material come out about them if they left, but that's not why they're in.
Tom Cruise does strike me as a guy who's just a true believer.
He's a seeker. He wants to belong. You know, before he was an actor, he was at the seminary. I mean, you know, he was training to become a Catholic priest. And there's an interesting way to look at his life and the fact that his father abandoned him and he was raised by his mother and his sisters and he never had a father figure. And so he kind of went searching for meaning, I think. And early on, he was, like I said, training to be a priest. And yeah, he's definitely grabbed on to something that gives his life meaning. And he, you know, the thing about Scientology, all this, you know, the staring contests and the other sort of really grueling, mind-bending early exercises, they are intended to indoctrinate you in the idea that L. Ron Hubbard really did discover the real secrets of the universe, and only Scientologists understand what's going on. The rest of us here on Earth are deluded fools that don't even realize we're living on a prison planet. And once you adopt that idea, Seth, it's really powerful. You think everyone else is wrong and only you're right.
Is it true from your research that L. Ron Hubbard once said that if you really want to make the good money, you need to start a religion?
Yeah, you know, he had been a pulp writer, a very, very successful pulp writer in the 30s, had then had kind of a disastrous war experience. He was a lieutenant in the Navy, had been hospitalized after the war. He claimed he'd been machine gunned in Java, but actually he was in the hospital. We got his records for pink eye and hemorrhoids. He came out and really spent a bad year after that. In 1947, we have a letter. He begged the VA for psychiatric care, which apparently he never got. And then in 48 and 49, he got real serious. He had written something initially in the late 30s, I think. But in 48 and 49, he got real serious about writing this book he wanted to do about how the mind works. And he would still go occasionally to these science fiction shows because he was still very well known for the writing he had done. And at least at a couple of these science fiction meetings, he said something like, you know, selling your writing at a penny a word is no way to get rich. If you really want to make money, you need to start a religion. And people will quote it with quotation marks, like, you know, there is no, it's something like that, right?
I think it said that Harlan Ellison, the famous sci-fi writer, had heard him say it, but I mean.
Well, Harlan told me that story personally, and I went to his house one day, and I love Harlan's telling. You can hear a YouTube version of him telling it to Robin Williams. It's a lot of fun. And he told me essentially the same story. Harlan's version, see, the version that we have in the FDA, which researched Scientology in the late 50s, early 60s, actually talked to some of these people who were there. And that's how we know this happened. So there was like this science fiction meeting in New Jersey. And he said that line that the real money's in starting a religion. Scientology hates this whole question. They claim it was Orwell that said it. And Orwell did say something similar. But it was but we had, you know, the FDA did research this, that there were people who were there who said Hubbard said this. Harlan's version is that there was this like writers club, and Harlan tells this real colorful story where, hey, you know, Hubbard really needs to make more money. Let's invent a religion for him. And Lester Del Rey came up with a name, and, you know, and everybody went around and they all invent. As much as I love Harlan Ellison, I have a real hard time with that story. I did the math at one point and realized that Harlan would have had to been like 14 and a half years old at the time. So I'm not sure that that really happened that way.
So, you know, here we have a guy, though, who is, I mean, I'll call him corrupt, but he's also seeking psychiatry or mental health help. So I'm caught in this place where I'm like, was he just a charlatan, a sociopath willing to take advantage of people by constructing this bogus and batshit religion? Or was he literally mentally ill, or both, right?
It's a great question. Lawrence Wright struggled with it in Going Clear. And he was saying, look, if the guy was just a con man, he would have walked away with the money, but he stayed in it, and he kept auditing himself to the end of his life. I think Lawrence is right that you have to think about it as kind of a combination of things where, and the same thing with Miscavige, who replaced Hubbard, is on some level, they really do believe this stuff, but they also have to know that the church isn't really helping anybody, and that the money situation really is. So I think it is some sort of combination. Now, there's a famous interview, Steve Kinnane wrote about this in his book, Fair Game. There's an English, I think it's an English, I've said Australian before, but I think it's an English journalist who caught up with Hubbard, I think in Tunisia. For several years, Hubbard ran Scientology from a ship. And the ship was in dock in Tunisia. And this journalist caught up with him, and it was the middle of the night. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, just this journalist and Hubbard on the deck of this boat. And the journalist says that he became very frank, because there was none of his little city organization people around him. And he admitted that he had created this thing, and now he was a prisoner of it. You know, he had no idea it was going to become so popular. And he had to keep up appearances because he was basically admitting it was all bullshit, but he couldn't walk away. It's a fascinating moment. And of course, the journalist says, I couldn't wait to come back with my camera and get this all on tape. But of course, the next day I came back and he had his crew around him, and he was completely different.
I think a journalist somewhere asked him, is there any chance that you're mad? And he was like, yeah.
Yeah. It was that interview. See, that interview they did the next day is the one you see.
I see.
But the night before, he had opened up to the guy and said that, you know, he'd created this fantasy, but now he was a prisoner of it.
Well, we could do a whole show on L. Ron Hubbard and whatnot. Let me come back to Leah Remini, which sort of leads me into her criticisms of Tom Cruise, for lack of a better word, criticisms. There's a 2013 article that, of course, you're familiar with. It revolves around the disappearance of Shelley Miscavige. Now, she's the wife of Scientology's leader and chairman of the board, David Miscavige. Right, she's the wife of the head honcho. Years ago, Shelley Miscavige suddenly vanished. And to my knowledge, nobody knows what happened. Is that right? Like, even now, Tony?
No, I mean, we have a pretty good idea of what happened. I can run through it if you want me to.
Okay, well, let me come back to that in just a second. But Leah Remini notices that at Tom Cruise's wedding to Katie Holmes, she's like, hey, where the hell is Shelley? And so she began to challenge, like, hey, people, somebody's got to explain this to me. Scientology does not like questions. Can you kind of take us down that road?
Sure. So, the wedding between Tom and Katie was November 2006, and it was in a castle in Italy, and David Miscavige was Tom's best man in that wedding, just as he had been previously in Tom's wedding to Nicole Kidman. So Leah was asking, where's Shelley? And it wasn't just that Shelley wasn't there, but the reaction shocked her. Tommy Davis, who was sort of this gopher and enforcer, came up to her angrily and said, you don't have the fucking rank to ask that question. And she was so struck by that response, it made her realize something's going on. And so she went back to her hotel room and wrote, she contacted a friend of hers in LA from Italy, and then all night wrote this report about all these things she had seen at the wedding. And not only was Shelley missing, but Dave had been getting a little too friendly with his assistant. So Leah was just horrified. And because she actually wrote a report turning in Miscavige. This is like a Catholic turning in the Pope,
oh,
right?
Oh, my God.
And so Scientology reacted by ordering her to the Flag Land Base in Clearwater, Florida, the spiritual mecca of Scientology, and put her through 3 or 4 months of intense interrogations that cost her $300,000.
Oh, wait, hang on just a second. She was taken to a reprogramming camp and they made her pay for the camp?
That's right. They put her through what's called the Truth Rundown, which is this wonderful Orwellian experience and Orwellian name, because what that rundown does by putting you through hour after hour after hour of questioning and questioning and questioning, they are waiting for it to get to the point where you can no longer trust what you saw with your own eyes. So by the end of the process, she has to come to the conclusion that the report she wrote was false, that she didn't see what she saw, and that she's fine with what happened in Italy. I mean, it's so Clockwork Orange. It's incredible. And she went through all that. But she writes about this in the book because that was the beginning of her journey out. Now, that happened in 2006. She didn't actually – the news – I broke the news that she was out of the church in July 2013. So it took several years for her to make that journey out. But we do know what happened with Shelley pretty well now. In late August or early September 2005, she and Dave had been living at the Hemet Base. It's called Gold Base or Int Base near Hemet, California. And that's a year earlier, Dave had created this prison there that they call the Hole. The Hole is at Gold Base. That's important to keep in mind. And so there were 60 or 70 executives already being kept prisoner in this office at that base. And Shelley did a couple of things that angered Dave. She like filled some job openings without his approval. She boxed up some of his belongings so there could be a renovation done. He had gone to LA for a while to work on a book project. He came back to the base. He was so angry that she had done some things on her own without his approval. He just blew his stack. And I have multiple eyewitnesses who were there at the time. And he just blew his stack. And several days later, after Shelley had been through some interrogations, Valerie Haney personally witnessed Shelley being marched to a car, put in, and they drove off. And nobody has seen her in 15 years since. In the summer of 2007, she was let out of where they're keeping her long enough to go to the funeral of her father. But that's it. Nobody has otherwise seen her in 15 years. Now, we know where they're keeping her. About 60 miles northwest of that place in Hemet, there's a smaller, even more secret compound near Lake Arrowhead, California. This is the headquarters compound of a super secret Scientology entity called the Church of Spiritual Technology, CST. Even the highest ranking Scientology Sea Org members are never allowed to go there. CST is its own little tiny world. There's probably only 12 or 15 people up there, one of whom is Shelley. And what the work they do at that little compound is the archiving of L. Ron Hubbard's materials. They have an underground vault. They put his lectures and books on special materials so that they will last thousands of years stored in this vault. So when there's possible civilization collapse, they can rebuild the world with Scientology. This is something Hubbard wanted done in a big corporate reorganization he did in 1981. So she's been up there for 15 years, kept out of sight, working on this program. Dave has essentially banished her. And John Brousseau, who knew Dave really well, in fact, he was his brother-in-law for 15 years, John Brousseau said on Leah's program, he will keep her there until she dies. And, you know, we have multiple lines of evidence that that's where they're keeping her. The police just do not care. It's amazing to me that Miscavige can get away with this.
A church prison. I'm just stuck on those two words. You know what I'm saying?
I know. I mean, what he did one day, see, Miscavige was, I have a theory about this. See, Miscavige had always been paranoid, but they had gone through a really tough period. They had a prisoner named Lisa McPherson die in 1995, and it became public a year later and blew up into one of the worst periods of publicity for the church in 1998. That era, that period, the church was actually indicted criminally in her death, and the family sued. So there was massive, massive bad publicity for several years. Biggest challenge up to that point. And they had managed to get that all solved. They went through some real skullduggery to get the criminal matter dropped and then ultimately got the lawsuit settled. And my theory is that through that period, Miscavige really needed all of his lieutenants. They had to get through this. It was so tough. Once they got past that, I think Miscavige felt invincible. And right around the time they were getting extricating from themselves from that, Miscavige now turned on his own people. He just saw enemies everywhere. He was sure they were plotting to, you know, rise against him or whatever. And in January 2004, at the Gold Base, he just took, you know, 25, 30 of these people, and it was an office, right? It's got desks. He puts them in there and just locks them in. And day after day after day, they had to sleep on the floor. They were brought food like slop in a bucket. And he would add more and more people. Mike Rinder was in there for like a year. 2004 to 2009, 5 years, that's what the conditions were like. Sleeping on the floor, no air conditioning in the summer. They were let out each morning, marched across the compound so they could take a shower, brought back, and then they had to do confessionals all day. They had to like do these what they called seances where they were trying to beat confessions out of each other. 5 years like that. The Tampa Bay Times revealed the existence of the hole in a big special in November 2009. And after that, Miscavige knew he couldn't keep them quite that under quite those kind of conditions. He allowed them now to sleep in apartments at night. But they're still segregated. There's still a hole. When Valerie Haney left in, I think, 2016 or 17, I talked to her about this. She said, "Oh yeah, the hole still exists. They're allowed to sleep in berthing at night, but they're still segregated. They're still considered being punished." That, and some of those people at that point have been in there for 13 years.
Now let me clarify: is this these people constitute what was like a board of directors? The only people that might have ever challenged him, he took them and sort of cordoned them off. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's like the, you know, if this was Amazon, Jeff Bezos had taken all his vice presidents and locked them in an office and threw away the key.
Okay, I see. And they're still there today?
It's, like I said, there it's the conditions aren't as harsh, but yes, there is this group of executives that are considered to be in the hole and being punished. And they never get to contact the outside world. They never get to contact their family. And it's going on 16 years now. It's just incredible. And you know, Mike Rinder has talked about this because he spent about a year in the hole.
Now, forgive the interruption. Tell everybody who Mike Rinder is very quickly.
Mike Rinder. So Mike Rinder was the international spokesman for Scientology. He was a longtime lieutenant to Miscavige, ran the public relations and spying wing of Scientology, the Office of Special Affairs, and famously defected in 2007 and was part of that Tampa Bay Times special in 2009, and then became Leah Remini's co-star in her series. And a really knowledgeable guy, really knows what he's talking about. And, you know, he was in the hole for about a year, and then he got pulled out of it because John Sweeney, the BBC, was investigating Scientology and Miscavige was freaking out. He needed Rinder to handle Sweeney. And if you watch that, Sweeney did two, I think the first one is called Scientology and Me. And if you watch that one, look at Rinder. He looks so gaunt.
He looks like a shell.
He's just been pulled out of the hole where they were being fed slop in a bucket. You know, I mean, so Rinder knows what he's talking about when he says what the conditions were like in there. And the important thing is that what you asked me about was, so, you know, the mentality, though, is that he said that you're in there, you figure you must have done something wrong because Miscavige is never wrong about anything. And if the FBI came breaking in there and threw the door open, you might not necessarily leave.
So Leah Remini has the gall to challenge David Miscavige. She pays a penalty, but they wouldn't shut her up. I mean, that's why the title of her memoir is Troublemaker. She was deemed a troublemaker. She wouldn't shun her family members because they were SPs or suppressive persons, and continued to sort of tap on the glass, ultimately exiting the church. She wrote this book. She talked a lot about Scientology, but she did not include a chapter that was largely dedicated to Tom Cruise. Why didn't she include the chapter back in 2015?
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the three of us, Leah, Mike, and me too. We were all going to be part of this Australian investigation being done by Brian Seymour at Channel 7 there, 7 News. I was interviewed for it in December, and I was surprised. I didn't realize it. Brian turned it into a 10-part series that the network was advertising. And if you watch the trailer, you see a lot of Leah and Mike in it and Paul Haggis. And so it looked like it was going to be very good, you know. And Brian had, when he interviewed me in December, had told me some things about what was going to be in it, and he was reporting on yet more examples of Scientology's dirty tricks and spying and intimidation. And so he interviewed me because he wanted me to put it in context of his Scientology's long history of that. And then after the network began advertising it early in July, it was supposed to be released, all 10 episodes at the same time, which I thought was kind of odd, but they were going to stream them all so you could binge them if you want, for July 9th. And then suddenly we were told they were delaying it until July 14th, which I thought was strange. And then on July 14th, not only were they not released, but the trailer was pulled down. So I got really concerned. I started looking into it. I made a source at Channel 7. They told me it's been killed. And sure enough, it's never going to be seen. So Leah and I were talking about this, and she was angry. I mean, she's talked about how, you know, she's really angry. And the first story I wrote about it was that she really believes Tom Cruise had a part in why it got removed.
Did she say why she believes that?
Well, because the series was going to really come down hard on Cruise and Tommy Davis. And Cruise and Tommy Davis were really tight with an Australian billionaire by the name of James Packer. In fact, even though Packer left Scientology in 2006 and Tommy Davis left his job in the Sea Org in 2011, they're still pretty close. In fact, Packer hired Tommy a few years ago to run he has a small Hollywood movie studio, or he did at that time. So they're still pretty close. And Leah and Mike both told me they believe that Tommy and Tom Cruise used their influence with Packer to get him to say something to Kerry Stokes, chairman of Channel 7. Kerry Stokes and James Packer are very close. And we don't have proof of it, but it's hard to understand it happening some other way, because they say repeatedly this series had been okayed by the lawyers at Channel 7. There was no legal concern. And yet at the last second, it got pulled for no apparent reason. So they, you know, Leah and Mike believe that Tommy Davis and Tom Cruise used their influence with James Packer, and Packer used his influence with the chairman of the network to have that pulled. And so we were talking about the series, and then, you know, I wanted to, you know, Lee and I were talking about what was going to be in it, and the in particular this operation that Tommy Davis and Tom Cruise had pulled off, and Leah starts sending me some, you know, written material about it. I'm like, what are you sending me? What is this? And it turns out she reveals to me she had like most of a chapter written about this stuff, about Tom Cruise in particular, but she had ultimately decided not to put it in her book. And I said, why not? And she, you know, when you're writing a book like that, you have to think about the response. And she told me her concern was if they put in this stuff about Tom Cruise, then that's all the media will be talking about. And, you know, she wanted this to be a memoir. She wanted people to understand what Scientology was about. She wanted people to focus on her whole journey. She just decided not to include that. But here she had sent it to me. And she kept sending me more material. And I said, well, how do you feel about making this public now? And she said, you know, she told me she was so angry that you know, because a lot of this was going to come out in that Channel 7 special. And she was so angry that Cruise, she believed, had been able to get it silenced. She decided, no, the public needs to know this stuff. And so she gave me the green light to make this material public on my website, which I did Monday morning.
I'll include that link in the description box. Who owns the 10-part Australian miniseries? I mean, can you put it on YouTube or something, or what?
Well, see, now, if it was, like, say, for example, Leah's series, Scientology in the Aftermath, that was on A&E. But what a show like that is made by a production company. And it's the production company that owns the material. So if for some reason Leah had shot a series of her show and A&E decided they didn't want it, she would then be able to sell it to another network. Okay. And we see that sometimes. You'll see a show move from one network to another. It's fairly rare, but it does happen because it's the production company that owns it, if it's made by a production company. In this case, however, this was a production made by that news network. This was a production of 7 News, not of a production company. So if the 7 News network decides to kill it, there's no way for the people who made it to sell it to somebody else. So I don't, unless somebody like leaks it on a torrent or something, I don't think that series is ever going to be seen.
I want to talk more about this culture of fear. And this especially includes the people who decide to go to work for Tom Cruise. Because they're not just working for Tom Cruise. I'm going to continue my discussion with Tony Ortega from the website The Underground Bunker. We will continue after this. Continuing my conversation with Tony Ortega. He is a journalist. He is an author. He runs the website The Underground Bunker, which reports pretty much daily on the cult of Scientology. The website is tonyortega.org. Still talking about Tom Cruise, one of the allegations is that the employees of Tom Cruise were essentially employees of the Church of Scientology. And if they did something wrong or they challenged Tom Cruise, the church actually stepped in and subjected Tom Cruise's employees to a kind of cult interrogation until they confessed. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, Leah's unpublished chapter that we published the other day, it's got some amazing stuff about when you went to work for Tom Cruise, you were suddenly taking orders from Tommy Davis, who, of course, was working for David Miscavige at the Church of Scientology. The people who work for the Church of Scientology, there's a couple different ways you can work for the church, but the thing that is most hardcore is something called the Sea Organization. To be a member of the Sea Org, as it's called, you have to sign a billion-year contract, and you work 365 days a year for, at the most, 40 cents an hour, when you're paid at all. And these people are completely dedicated and work around the clock. They get maybe 4 or 5 hours off a day. And if you go to work for Tom Cruise and his production company, Odin Productions, you're not joining the Church of Scientology. You're just, you know, a producer or a, you know, some, you know, somebody who wants to make movies or television. You shouldn't be subjected to those rules. And that was the shocking thing, was that for these people that went to work for his entertainment company suddenly found themselves subject to those kinds of conditions, just low pay, extreme hours, being screamed at, and taking orders from Scientology operatives. This is what, you know, Leah really lays out well in this chapter.
But if I'm Tom Cruise, I'm not ignorant of this stuff, right? I know there's abuses going on. I see people who are being paid pennies a day. I see that there are prisons. I mean, do you think Tom Cruise is aware that all this crazy shit is going on?
I mean, he'd have to be the most unobservant human being in history not to realize it.
Because, you know, obviously the criticism is, what the hell? How can he enable this type of abuse by being arguably the biggest asset of the Church of Scientology, right?
Right. And that's what Leah said she wanted to expose, was that, you know, Tom benefits from this way of working, and Tom participates in it. He's complicit. You know, he, for example, when you're going through these interrogations in Scientology, Scientology is a snitching culture. It's an interrogation culture. And somebody has said something about you, or you've said something to somebody else, and they pull you in, and you're put through these intense interrogations that go on for hours and hours, for days and days. Everything's written down. And then things are pulled out of that file to be used in other ways. So Tom has to know that this was done to Nicole Kidman, that private material from her confessional folders was used to encourage him to break up with her. When he wanted to date Nazanin Boniadi, or when Shelley Miscavige wanted him to date Nazanin Boniadi, this young Scientologist actress, they pulled confessional material from her then boyfriend's supposedly confidential files to show her, to horrify her about some things that he had said that he was lying to her about, to break them up, so that Tom Cruise could then date Nazanin.
Okay, so let me back up. Forgive the interruption, but I want to make sure we're being clear.
Yeah.
Nicole Kidman had drifted from the Church of Scientology, and as a result, right, Tom Cruise had sort of drifted with her, which caused the church great alarm. Holy shit, Tom Cruise is not really active like he was. So the church made it a mission to get him away from Nicole and the kids. Is that an accurate way to say it?
That's right. Okay. And we didn't know about this till many years later, that he and the, when they got married in 1990, she initially was really cooperative and worked very hard at being a Scientologist. I've talked to her auditor. She got all the way to OT2, which is just an amazing amount of work in just a couple of years. She must have been very, very dedicated to it. But then she soured on it. And I think she soured on Miscavige in particular. And she pulled away from the church, and she pulled Tom away. And so from 1992 to when they broke up in 2000, Tom was largely out of Scientology. But Scientology kept that quiet. None of us knew it until later. Tom would come back occasionally in 98. For example, he came to the Hollywood Celebrity Center, did some stuff with Tommy Davis. But he was far enough away from it that it really, like you said, alarmed Miscavige. Miscavige had him spied on. And so the church did encourage Tom to break up with her in 2000, and they split up. And then Miscavige really made it the job of the church to get Tom back in deeply. But yeah, part of the way they make those kind of things happen is, again, by mining the material in these supposedly confidential folders. And Tom They did that to Nicole, and then they did that to Nazanin with her boyfriend, and so that Tom could date her. I mean, Tom has to know this kind of stuff is going on. He can't be ignorant of it.
That's probably one of the more controversial Tom Cruise Scientology stories, right? He mentioned that Nazanin has a boyfriend. They need that to go away so that she can date Tom, or they can assign her to Tom is what it looks like, right? So they come at her and they're like, hey, the boyfriend you got, the guy you're dating, he's doing a bunch of crazy shit and he's being duplicitous and you need to dump him. So they convince Nazanin to walk away. And then what, they ship him off? It's like they delivered her to Tom, like an object. I mean, what the hell?
It was really well portrayed in the movie Going Clear. They put her through a makeover. You know, they got her new clothes and they got her hair done. I think they even they filed down her incisors.
What?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrifying. I mean, I think we're laughing out of disbelief, but oh my God. So they file her teeth even.
Yeah. And get her all dolled up. And then, she dates Tom from, I think, November 2004 to January 2005.
Until she says something critical to or about Miscavige and it all blows up.
She had a hard time understanding him. He's got this thick Philly accent. And she just really had a difficult time, and she wasn't enjoying being around him, and that just doesn't work for Tom. So he had Tommy Davis break up with her, which is really sad.
Wait, he had Tommy Davis facilitate their separation?
Yeah, that's one of the things Leah is really critical about Tom. You know that he couldn't do it himself.
Now, Nazanin is not speaking, right? She's under what looks like, I mean, I'll just call it a threat, this non-disclosure that she and I guess everybody who works for Tom Cruise has to sign. Hang on just a second. Let me just roll through some of this. If you say something damaging or consider damaging about Tom Cruise, according to the NDA, you're fined $50,000 for each individual time you say it, a minimum of $1 million for every publication the allegations are printed in, $250,000 for every copy of a book sold that contains the allegation, with a minimum of another $1 million, $5 million fine for every TV broadcast it's in. So if you do a TV interview and you say something untoward about Tom, $2 million for a non-TV broadcast criticism. That's radio and online, I'm guessing. Other penalties. Holy shit. I mean, the stuff they are locked down and not saying anything. Otherwise, they will be personally and financially ruined.
Yeah, people ask me all the time, when is Nicole going to say something? When is Katie going to say something? I say, never.
Wow.
They're, so yeah, Nazanin, I don't know that it's necessarily the NDA that keeps Nazanin quiet. But, you know, Leah in this unpublished chapter, or actually in our discussion, it was a combination of things she had written and things she had said to me. Talked about the things that, you know, she had conversations with Nazanin. Leah personally spoke to Nazanin and revealed some new information that we put out on Monday on the blog.
How much of the chapter did you publish? The unpublished chapter from the memoir?
She gave me a combination of some stuff that was, you know, written, stuff that was notes. And then we talked a lot, and I put it all in there. I mean, I don't think it was a full chapter, but it was a pretty lengthy piece. I had some people complaining to me that, Tony, it's too much for me to read.
But
I thought it was great.
Welcome to the internet, right? I mean, they're used to reading Twitter bylines. So any of these Scientology folks showing up at your doorstep? I know they've been doing that to Render and other people, taunting and threatening and carrying on. Any of that going on with you?
No, you know, I emailed Tommy Davis. I reached out to Tom's attorney, Bert Fields, reached out to the church. But, you know, as usual, I'm not hearing anything, and we'll see if anything else happens. But Leah's got some power these days. You know, people, when you have a hit show like that, you know, people really do listen to her, and she's really good at what she does. She's just She's so good at making people passionate about this stuff. I think.
I'm a fan. Like she, you know, she has completely reinvented herself, and she's obviously speaking with tremendous conviction and authority about what she experienced and trying to help other people. I think she might be the most influential voice. No offense, Tony.
No question. No question. She reaches so many people. And I'm, you know, and the thing is, I broke the news that she had left in 2013. And, you know, it took a couple of years, 2 years until the book came out, and then another year and a half, 2 years for the TV show to start. You might remember that she also did like a reality show about her family and a couple of times mentioned Scientology in there. And I think over this period, she had, you know, the tough thing is, I'll tell you, and Leah never said anything to me about this. This is just from my own observation of what she has been through and other people who were celebrities, is just getting out of Scientology is so difficult. And then adapting is so difficult. And then she's got to get her career on track. You know, she kind of had a little bit of a downtime there during that period when she was coming out. I mean, she obviously had so much success with King of Queens. But, you know, when she first came out of Scientology, she did Ellen's show, and then she did Dancing with the Stars. She did this little reality show. But, you know, I know she wanted to come out and speak out about Scientology, but you have to figure that her entertainment side people were like, look, you don't want to be known as the critic of Scientology. You want to be known as the comedic actress, right? So I think there was a lot of soul searching she had to go through before she decided, no, let's do a show about Scientology. And then that first episode was seen by like 2 million people or something. I mean, it was for cable, it was a huge hit. It was the biggest hit A&E had had for years. So what vindication, right? And I'm sure her entertainment people were like, oh, okay, this is going to work. So, you know, anybody that goes through that has to make that decision. Do I really want my career to become about this? But she has embraced it. And I think people admire her so much for it.
Here's the kick in the teeth. I'm looking at the numbers, membership numbers, on the decline. People are more and more getting wise, walking away, sounding the warnings. And yet, the Church of Scientology has invested in what, real estate and property, and become and generating income in other ways. Like, they're still freaking huge. I was thinking they would be waning and going away. I mean, what's going on there?
It is a strange paradox that they're smaller than ever. Scientology has never had the millions of people it always claimed. At its height around the year 1990, after there were several years of a very successful advertising campaign with these television volcano ads for Dianetics. At its height around then, it had about 100,000 people. It never had the 6 or 8 million that it always claimed. But then that Time Magazine cover story came out in May 1991, calling it a global cult of greed or whatever. And it started shrinking, and it's been shrinking ever since. And when Mike Rinder came out, when Jefferson Hawkins came out, 2005, 2007, Jefferson's estimate was that it was down to only about 40,000, and it's continued to shrink. And so estimates today, again, from some of the top former executives with access to enrollment documents, is that it's now gone under 20,000. 20,000 people that can't even fill an arena, right? And yet they've got two things going for them. First of all, because they have tax exempt status, they can ignore labor laws, and so they pay their workers virtually nothing. Second of all, they still have these wealthy donors who can't wait to give them millions of dollars. In fact, according to I keep track of this stuff. I keep track of the millionaires and how much they give. They, you know, several times a year they have these celebrations of them. Miscavige is getting more millionaires than ever to turn over big donations right now. So the combination of big donations, no taxes, low labor costs, he's got more money than ever, even with a smaller and smaller membership.
Is the IRS still looking the other way or what?
Yeah, the problem for the IRS is they signed this agreement with Scientology in 1993 that gave them tax exempt status. And
That was a fascinating story, right? Because they were coming, the IRS is coming after their massive income. Scientology mobilizes and they just stuff the courts with literally thousands of individual lawsuits against the IRS until the Internal Revenue Service just gives up and cries uncle, right? They're like, oh, screw this. Just give them tax exempt status and call them a religion.
They went to war with them. They not only filed all those lawsuits, but they were surveilling them and playing dirty tricks on them. Yes. Like, you know, they would do these things where like an individual IRS employee happens to have like some rentals, right? And he owns a little, you know, a little fourplex where he rents out to people. So they would find a way to have people filing code violations on that property just to be a nuisance to the IRS guy that happens to own it. I mean, that's the level. See, that's the thing that separates Scientology, the granularity of their nefarious schemes. They will get down to that level to put everybody at the IRS on edge and get them all freaked out. So finally, in October 1991, Miscavige got an audience with the IRS commissioner under George Bush the First. Who was this guy named Fred Goldberg, and Marty Rathbun was with Miscavige in this meeting. And, you know, Miscavige was like, listen, can't we find a way to end this? And Goldberg pulled Marty aside because Miscavige said, listen, if we can just work this out, all this other stuff will go away. And Goldberg pulls Marty aside, said, is he telling the truth? Well, all this, you know, and Marty said, absolutely. And he said, Marty told me that Fred Goldberg's shoulders slumped like, you know, oh, OK, I'm done. And sure enough, Goldberg then ordered. Now, it didn't happen overnight. He ordered a study to be done of the situation, but hamstrung it. He said, you're going to investigate Scientology for tax exempt status, but you can't ask them all these questions. He really limited it. And I've talked to tax experts who had reported on it at the time, and they tell me this was a done deal from the beginning. Now, it took a couple of years. Scientology had to jump through a lot of hoops, which they like to point through. Oh, we turned in all these documents. We were very, we're very transparent, and we followed all the rules. It was a done deal. It was started under George Herbert Walker Bush. It was finished under Clinton. October 93, they got everything they wanted, not only tax-exempt status, but tax-exempt status for everything, all of their entities. And that's it. They're done. The IRS is done. They never want to hear Scientology's name again. So in order to get them to reopen that would take so much. It's all inertia. I mean, it would take so much momentum from politicians, from the public, from the president, everybody. And they're just it's just really difficult to make that happen.
Which is probably much of the focus of your work. You're just trying to light a fire under people. Hey, this shit's going on. And if it doesn't change, then it never changes, kind of thing, right?
So yeah, I'm not sure that, you know, Tony Ortega and his website is going to have that kind of influence. I was, you know, one of the things I think we were all interested in this was to see whether Leah and the influence she has in a hit TV show could generate that kind of interest. But even Leah, by her third season, just sounded so frustrated that she wasn't seeing more movement. I think the tax exempt thing is probably a bridge too far. I think the government, if there's going to be government action, it's probably more likely going to be in financial law enforcement, obstruction of justice. Scientology is breaking the law every day of the week. It's not that there's nothing to investigate. It's just, where's the will to investigate? Where's the will to charge? And I know personally that federal agencies are interested and are looking into this. But to get these government officials to pull the trigger and file charges, Mike Rinder explained it really well to me one day. He said, look, here's the issue. The issue is, say you're a middle manager at some government agency and you're the one who's got to make up this, you know, put together this proposal to go after the Church of Scientology and really investigate it for what it's guilty of, and you've got to get your superiors to sign off on it. You have to make a decision. Are you ready for this to become the rest of your career? Because it's going to be 10 years at least of fighting with Scientology's very well-paid army of lawyers and private investigators. So I know people are surprised when you tell them that, yes, Scientology is committing crimes every day of the week, and no, law enforcement isn't doing anything about it. But you have to understand, those are the kinds of decisions that people need to make. Are they ready to go to the mat? And so far, we haven't found anybody that is.
Reminds me of New York and Chicago taking on the mob in the late 20th century, mid to late 20th century. I mean, that's a, you know, the implications are staggering. You know, we open up that rabbit hole and go down there, and who knows what's going to happen next. So,
yeah, it's not a question of whether the crimes are being committed. It's a question of do you have the resources, do you have the manpower, and do you have the will? And that's another issue with the IRS. The IRS has been decimated under Trump in particular, but even under the Republican Congress with Obama. The IRS is in really bad shape right now. They are not in any kind of shape to take on the Church of Scientology.
You know, just to finish up here, Tony, if you and I were not moral people or, you know, whatever, if you and I were really clever, we'd start a church. You could found Ortegaism, you know, something like that. And we could.
Well, you know, John Oliver did that.
Did he?
he created a nonprofit church just to prove that you could, and just in a purely cynical way. Absolutely.
I mean, I would worship at Ortega's church. I would just, my tithe may not be large, I'd be there in earnest. So, man, I appreciate your perspective. You've been generous to give me more than an hour of your time. I am a fan. I share your stuff all the time. I really do think it makes a difference. I mean, it's really going to have to be a death by a thousand cuts. I think we just keep kicking. I mean, I don't know what else to do. Do you?
Well, the number one thing I try to do is just make people aware. You know, Scientology does not want you to know what it's about when you first get in. The come on is completely, it's a bait and switch. So I feel like one of the things that I could do is at least give people the information they need. Now, if after you've read my website, and you understand about what Hubbard was about, and you understand what Scientology, and you still want to go in, then go ahead. That's fine. But I want people to have that information and not be duped the way so many people have been.
Your website, I'm going to put the link to Leah's book in there, maybe a few other Scientology-related links so that our listeners can go deeper to find out more, to get educated, because knowledge is power. Tony Ortega, you're a good man. Thanks so much for being on the show. It's been an honor to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's been fun.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.